from scheduling, so he's going to do double duty, and he can say, well, I'm going to go.
Oh, sorry, I thought
somebody has to remind me to make sure we have enough copies to hand out.
And then next Thursday, June Mickelson from our genetic counseling group, you met Molly Hutton before, since this is June, our other counselor, is going to be talking about genetic counseling in the background of breast cancer. We do think of BRCA1 and 2 as the two genes most involved. There are other genes involved, too. So she'll give you the scenarios of counseling those patients. And then Friday, we kind of flipped it because of availability, Dr. Jessica Young, who is our one of the breast surgeons here, is going to be talking about breast cancer, more of the clinical aspect. And then we're done, guys. That's it. So, we will have a final exam from Tuesday, the usual format. Hopefully we should be in home for that. We're going to give you the exams back, exam number 3, but I'll give you a preview. Your class average is 89. And our lowest grade is 72, the highest grade is 98.5, so everybody gets a deal. Congratulations. How was the program on Tuesday? Was it worthwhile too?
Good. It's pretty cool, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. I love a good cops like what if question.
Yeah. Okay, all right. I just don't want this to be didactic for you. I want you to, you know enough now to sit in and listen to these lectures. So we will come up with a take home question that will be relevant to what most of you guys heard. That will be the take home. I'm not sure what I'm going to do about I might have a visiting class, but it's kind of a general question. Any other questions for me? Okay, I've been delayed Dr. Chen long enough. Dr. George Chen is one of our transplanters. We'll talk about
okay.
The whole thing.
Yeah, the whole thing.
Can you give him a little bit of background, where you came from and study?
Oh. Okay, so hi, I'm George Chen. You do your usual thing, the undergraduate and then medical school, and then I trained in medicine in Houston, and then I did a hematology-oncology residency there as well, and then I did a transplant fellowship at Stanford, and then I came here, and so I've been here for 7 years. Doing clinical transplant. So, and then this lecture is almost exactly the same as the one I gave earlier this year. So, kind of. Okay, anyways. So we're going to talk about hematopoietic cell transplant, and this is a modality for treating malignancies, mostly hematologic malignancies. And so this is the transfer of hematopoietic progenitor and stem cells for therapeutic purposes. And, there are various names for it. So all of that is, based on the hierarchy for hematopoiesis. And so the only reason that we can do stem cell transplants now is because there is a stem cell that gives rise to all these other blood cells, the white blood cells, platelets, and red blood cells. And so if you transfer this unit, in addition to sometimes these units over here, then you can get full reconstitution of a patient's hematopoietic system. So this is the usual patient with a malignancy, and so its malignancy is represented by these spiky cells here. And so I think what you've learned this semester is that, these patients usually receive some form of chemotherapy and radiation therapy, and that gets rid of the tumor, or at least cytoreduces it, because sometimes there's a little bit left behind. And so what tends to happen is that for certain malignancies, if you don't do anything further, then the tumor will regrow. And so where transplant usually fits in is in this part of the process. And so what we hope to do with a transplant is that we can prevent further tumors from regrowing, or we can get rid of the tiny bit that is left behind. Okay, so these are, overall outcomes from allogeneic bone marrow transplant. And the The sad truth is that, you know, after an allogeneic transplant, only about 20% of patients are alive and well, meaning, you know, they're back to work or they don't have any complications of transplant. A lot of the patients are retired, so they're kind of out doing their thing. But a significant proportion of patients will be alive, but they'll have chronic graft versus host disease, which we'll talk about a little bit later on. And then, you know, probably close to 20% of patients will still have their disease come back even after an allogeneic transplant. And then the remainder will have died. So almost 50% of patients will die after an allogeneic transplant because of various complications like graft versus host disease or infection and some other reasons. So then, you know, you kind of really have to wonder why patients will even agree to undergo a transplant if the long-term survival is so poor. And so this is the way I like to break it down for patients. You know, usually if you have a patient with leukemia, they'll get your usual induction and consolidation chemotherapy, and that hopefully will put them in a remission. And so that's, you know, that's usually the time point when the patients will come and see us as transplanters. And so the options available to the patient at that point are to do nothing and basically observe them to see what happens to them. So that's this arm down here, the lower arm. And if they do nothing, then, you know, probably about 95% of them will be dead in 5 years because of relapse. And so this is for bad prognosis leukemia. Not all leukemias are poor prognosis, but the ones that we see for transplant are almost uniformly bad prognosis. And so if you do nothing, then 95% of them will have disease relapse, and then they will die because the treatment is ineffective, and maybe 5% will have long-term survival. And if they agree to undergo a transplant, so represented by these orange cells here, then, you know, probably about 45% of them will have long-term survival at 4 to 5 years. And then 55% will die from the complications of transplant. So the crucial issue for transplanters is how do you reduce this percentage of complication? And we can talk about some of those things as well. Okay. So this is a different way of looking at the process. So these are patients with leukemia, and they split these patients up into good prognosis patients, so patients that were NPM1 positive, and then patients that had poor prognosis or intermediate prognosis, so all the other genetic mutations that you could find. And so in each graft, they've divided the patients into two groups. One group had a donor with which they could receive an allogeneic transplant, and then the other group had a donor that had a and then the other group did not have a donor available. And so for the good prognosis leukemia patients, there's no difference in recurrence of leukemia. You know, the curves are practically upon each other. But in the patients with intermediate or poor prognosis leukemias, then the ones who went through the allogeneic donor transplant had a better relapse-free survival than the patients who did not have a donor. And this is just another way of looking at the same thing. So these are the prognostic categories for AML. You don't have to know this. Don't worry. But you know, just so that you're aware that this is kind of how we decide whether or not we should take a patient to transplant or not to transplant. So the ones that we would take to transplant are the ones with medium or poor prognosis or clinical factors that indicate a poor prognosis. Okay. So these are the things that you should take away from this lecture. You should know the difference between an autologous and allogeneic transplant, the different kinds of conditioning regimens, the different donor sources. You should know something about acute and chronic graft versus host disease, and you don't have to know anything about donor chimerism because we won't talk about it. So an autologous transplant is essentially a transplant using a patient's own cells for the graft. An allogeneic transplant uses another person's hematopoietic cells for the graft. It's very basic. And this is the schema for an autologous. Is there questions? So this is the schema for an autologous transplant. This is your typical patient that has some sort of cancer. They go through the regular chemotherapy, and then their cancer is cytoreduced. At about this time, we will collect their stem cells. You know, these are collected by apheresis or bone marrow harvest, and they're frozen away. From here, the patient undergoes high-dose chemotherapy. The high-dose chemotherapy gets rid of this last bit of cancer, we hope. Unfortunately, it also destroys the bone marrow, so that's not really compatible with life. So to rescue the patients from the side effects of the high-dose chemotherapy, we will give them the stem cells that were frozen away for them. And then over about 8 to 14 days, these stem cells grow back and the bone marrow regenerates. So this is the these are the dose response curves for, you know, various tumors, hypothetical tumors. And so in this curve on the left, you have increasing cytoreduction with increasing chemotherapy dose. On this curve on the left, on the right, you have a plateau in chemo responsiveness. The question, so if you're faced with this sort of dilemma about thinking about whether or not an autologous transplant will work for a patient, what do you have any thoughts about which curve you would rather see? Anybody? This one? No? The one on the left. Right, so you would want the curve on the left, because the entire reason that a transplant, an autologous transplant, works is because of the chemotherapy that you give in this part of the process. All of this, all of the cell collection and freezing and reinfusing, the actual transplant part, is there to mitigate the side effect from the high-dose chemotherapy. So you would choose this one. Okay, so these are the indications for high-dose chemotherapy and autologous transplant. Basically, you want a tumor that is responsive to high-dose chemotherapy. So things like testicular cancer, large cell lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma, myeloma. And the reason that you give the transplant, the reason that you do this is so that you can replace the hematopoiesis that was damaged by the high-dose chemotherapy, so that the patient can regenerate the white blood cells, red blood cells, platelets, and go on and live their lives. So this is the schema for an allogeneic transplant. It's also very similar to the schema for an autologous transplant, except that instead of collecting stem cells from the patient, we will perform a donor search, and we will have donor cells brought to the patient. And so after the patient has gone through standard chemotherapy and then finally high-dose chemotherapy to get rid of this residual cancer, we'll give the donor cells, and then over time the donor cells will grow back in the patient. We hope, because there is a disparity between the donor and the recipient, that there will be an immunologic reaction and that the donor cells will remove the last bit of cancer, usually leukemia, from the patient, and then in the long run, we hope that there's a cure for the patient. Okay, so these are the indications for an allogeneic transplant. The most important thing is that you want an immune-mediated effect against the underlying malignancy. Because if you don't need this immune-mediated effect, then you could just do an autologous transplant. We like to utilize this immune-mediated effect to prevent relapse. And then along the way, we have replacement of hematopoiesis as well. Okay. So this is just to summarize the differences between an autologous and allogeneic transplant. You get replacement of hematopoiesis with both grafts. With an autologous transplant, you are essentially relying on cytoreduction to get rid of the tumor. For an allogeneic transplant, it kind of depends on what kind of allogeneic transplant that you do. There is no immune effect usually with an autologous transplant, whereas the immune effect is kind of what the allogeneic transplant is about. And then with regard to chemotherapy doses, all conditioning regimens for autologous transplants are myeloablative, Whereas for an allogeneic transplant, they could be myeloablative, reduced intensity, or non-myeloablative. Okay, so we'll discuss myeloablative versus reduced intensity versus non-myeloablative conditioning regimens at this time. So, so this is the schema for an allogeneic transplant, and the standard transplant was to use high-dose chemotherapy to prepare the recipient to receive the donor cells. And so this did, you know, the rationale for this was two things. The first was that the high dose of chemotherapy would get rid of any residual tumor that was left behind. And then the second was that the high dose of chemotherapy would immunosuppress the recipient so that there would not be any rejection of donor cells. And so what we found was that when you had leukemia, the leukemia was not necessarily dose responsive. So this is what, you know, you would expect for an autologous transplant. You would want for an autologous transplant this dose response curve where you give more chemotherapy and you have more of a tumor response. But what we found was that in leukemias, you could give up to a certain point. You could give chemotherapy up to a certain point, but then beyond that, there wasn't any more further cytoreduction of the tumor. And what happened is that all of this extra chemotherapy that you gave just caused extra toxicity. So to try to get around this, we decided, not me, but you know, transplanters in general, decided that instead of giving high-dose chemotherapy, we would give a non-myeloablative or reduced intensity regimen. And so what this did was that it was enough to hold the leukemia under control, and then it was also enough to immunosuppress the patient without giving too much chemotherapy so that there wasn't all of this toxicity. And so over time, what would happen is that the donor cells would come in and then they would grow. For some period of time, you would have both recipient and donor cells together in the same patient. And then over about a month to 3 months, this patient would slowly convert over to being completely donor in terms of the hematopoietic system. So this is one way of looking at myeloablative versus non-myeloablative conditioning regimens. With a myeloablative conditioning regimen, the bone marrow does not recover. They can go for months and months and months, and then nothing grows back. With a non-myeloablative conditioning regimen, there is still some residual recipient that's left behind even after the chemotherapy, and then this residual recipient grows back over several months. Okay. So, you know, when they first proposed that, people thought that the transplanters were crazy, that they should be put in jail for this because, you know, it was thought that you were giving suboptimal therapy, because prior to that, the teaching had been that the more chemo, the better to get rid of tumor. So these smart Germans finally did a trial where they compared reduced intensity conditioning versus standard conditioning, which is myeloablative conditioning. And what they found was that the non-relapse mortality, so this is death from complications of transplant, was about the same whether or not you gave standard or reduced intensity conditioning. The overall survival was about the same. The disease-free survival was about the same. And finally, the relapse rate was about the same. So the outcome really did not change whether or not you got myeloablative or reduced intensity conditioning regimen. And so when they looked more closely at who these patients were that were responding, then they found that if you were 18 to 40 years old, it really didn't matter. You could get a myeloablative conditioning regimen and you would do just fine. But if you were 41 to 60, and then they didn't transplant anyone over 60 because they thought it was too toxic, they found that if you received a standard conditioning regimen, you had almost twice the amount of complications from the transplant as if you received a reduced intensity conditioning regimen. And this was with the same overall survival. So that's why in older adults, we will opt to do a reduced intensity conditioning regimen rather than a myeloablative conditioning regimen. Okay. So these are the different transplant regimens that we give. Over on the right side are the myeloablative conditioning regimens. On the left side are the non-myeloablative conditioning regimens. And then in the middle are reduced intensity conditioning regimens. And so what we see is that as we become more myeloablative, we have more and more regimen-related toxicity. As we move into the non-myeloablative direction, then there is a little bit more relapse. So it's kind of a trade-off between what you want. You know, you can either have your patient die of leukemia, or you can have them die of complications from transplant. I think most of us prefer that. I mean, we prefer that they don't die, but if we have to choose, I think we would rather that they died of the disease that they had rather than of something that we did to them. So that's why there is this tendency to do more and more reduced intensity conditioning regimens now. This is the hematopoietic hierarchy that we've seen before. And so you have to wonder, why is it that certain chemotherapy drugs result in a myeloablative conditioning, whereas other drugs do not? And so the reason is that certain drugs, such as busulfan, melphalan, full-dose total body irradiation up to 12 grays, affect the entire hematopoietic tree, including the stem cell. And so if you receive one of these agents, then your stem cells will die off, and that's what accounts for the myeloablative capabilities of these drugs. Whereas if you give a different drug, such as fludarabine, this drug only affects the lymphoid cell line. It doesn't affect the hematopoietic stem cell. So you can give fludarabine in your conditioning regimen, and you will have immunosuppression because you're getting rid of lymphocytes, but you won't ablate the bone marrow. And finally, there is this fantastic new drug, not new drug, but this, we think it's pretty fantastic. This fantastic drug called cyclophosphamide, which affects all of these cells in the black box, but not the hematopoietic stem cell. And the reason that it does not affect the hematopoietic stem cell is because of the way it's metabolized. So this is the metabolic pathway for cyclophosphamide. It gets converted to aldophosphamide. Aldophosphamide can be detoxified in cells by aldehyde dehydrogenase into carboxyphosphamide, which is inactive. Aldophosphamide can also become phosphoramide mustard, which is the active agent, the active metabolite, or acrolein, which is also an active metabolite, but actually causes a lot of bladder toxicity. And so aldehyde dehydrogenase is elevated in stem cells. It's also elevated in resting lymphocytes and not in activated lymphocytes. It's much reduced in activated lymphocytes. So that's why, you know, these cells are preserved when they see cyclophosphamide. They can detoxify it into something that's non-toxic. Whereas these lymphocytes, these other cells mostly, if they're active, then they are susceptible to the cyclophosphamide. Okay. So this is just to compare the differences between autologous transplant, allogeneic reduced intensity conditioning, and allogeneic myeloablative conditioning. So you can replace rescue of hematopoiesis with all three. In terms of cytoreduction, you have it with autologous transplant, and you have some with a reduced intensity conditioning allogeneic regimen, and then you theoretically have more with a myeloablative regimen, although in certain diseases like leukemia, where there's a plateau in the dose response curve, we don't see that as much. In terms of immune effects, we see immune effects mostly in allogeneic transplants. With chemotherapy dose, the autologous transplants have a high chemotherapy dose because this is what is treating the patient, treating the tumors in autologous transplant. It's much lower in reduced intensity conditioning regimens and then higher in myeloablative conditioning regimens. And then in terms of toxicity to the patient, the ones that have the most are autologous transplants, myeloablative, allogeneic transplants, and then there's less in reduced intensity transplants. Okay, so we will talk about the different donor sources now. So this is entirely based on HLA typing in patients. And so human leukocyte antigens are proteins which present antigenic peptides to T cells, and they are on the surface of most body cells. These are the proteins that are responsible for graft rejection and graft versus host disease. So in an autologous transplant, HLA doesn't matter because you use your own cells. There really aren't any differences. And so this really only matters if you are thinking about allogeneic transplants. It's just a cartoon of the different HLA types. And then just to give you an idea of the diversity, there are many polymorphisms in the different HLA antigens that are on the cell. So it's estimated that more than 1 times 10 to the 24th power combinations are available, although not all frequencies are equally represented. Okay. So this is how HLA is inherited. You have two parents up here, mom, dad, and then these are the children down here. And so the inheritance proceeds in a Mendelian fashion. So, you know, one child will have the opportunity to inherit one of the maternal haplotypes and then one of the paternal haplotypes. And each child has this. And so if you have a sibling, you have a 25% chance of having the same haplotype as that sibling. So this is how we calculate the chances of having a matched sibling, depending on the number of siblings that you have. And the important thing to remember is this is the number of other siblings that you use in this equation. It's not the number of total siblings. So if you have 4 brothers and sisters in the family, the chance of having a matched sibling is 1 minus 0.75 to the 3rd power, not to the 4th power. Okay, so these are the different HLA antigens that are on each cell. And so when we talk about a 6 out of 6 HLA matched donor, then what we're really talking about is, what we really mean is that DRB1, B, and A are matched in both the donor and recipient. So the donor and recipient still have these other HLA antigens. It's just that when the nomenclature started, we were only able to type DRB1, B, and A. We weren't able to type C, D, Q, or DP, and so that's where this came up. So later on, we were able to type the C antigen, and so that's where the terminology 8 out of 8 HLA match comes from. Once again, these are the 8 in the donor, and these are the 8 in the recipient. And finally, we're up to 10 out of 10 matched. And then the most recent iteration is a 10 out of 10 matched, meaning these 10 up here. And then DP is either matched, permissive, or non-permissive. Okay. So this is what a haploidentical donor looks like. If the recipient is haploidentical to the donor, then that means that only one of the haplotypes is the same. So it's the, you know, it's of course either the maternal or the paternal haplotype. Okay, so what do you think an A antigen mismatch donor means? Any clues?
Everything matches with the A on one side.
Right. So in this case, this is the only one that is mismatched. And then the situation often comes up where when we are choosing donors in which you don't have any fully matched donors, but maybe one antigen is mismatched. So for this recipient, there are 2 donors available, and these 2 donors are mismatched at one antigen. One is mismatched at B and the other is DQ. And so the way we choose between these 2 donors, because this actually comes up quite frequently, is that we look at the expression level of the antigens. So the high expression level antigens are DRB1, A, B, and C. And then the low expression level antigens are DQ, DP, and then DRB3, 4, and 5. So we don't do DRB3, 4, and 5 typing. We only type DQ and DP. So if you have... And so the one to choose is the one with the low expression level allele, because that presents less antigenic difference to the donor when the donor cells come into the recipient. And so if you are ever faced with this situation where you have either a B mismatch to choose from or a DQ mismatch to choose from, then the donor that you should choose is the DQ, because this is the low expression level allele, and so we hope that there is less difference and then consequently less, fewer complications from transplant. Okay. So this is just a graph, this is just a figure to show the relative degree of mismatch between the different donor types. So this is the recipient. This is what we would call a one antigen mismatch, a low expression level antigen mismatch. This is a high expression level antigen mismatch. And then this is a haploidentical donor, if the red is where the mismatch is. Okay. Other ways to, so HLA antigen matching is the most important way to select donors. The other criteria that we use are cytomegalovirus status, age, so the younger the better. And then we like to match genders, although we can have different genders in the donor-recipient pair. And then the one thing that we sometimes use, but usually we ignore, is the ABO blood type. So it's nice if we can get the same ABO blood type, but if it's not, then we don't worry so much. All of the HLA antigen matching will actually trump that. Okay. So we'll talk about acute and chronic graft versus host disease. So, you know, the allogeneic grafts that we use have immunologic effects, and so there is a graft versus tumor effect that we hope happens to get rid of the tumor. And then in the same direction, but at a different location on the body, are graft versus host effects. And so this is the reaction of the graft cells against the recipient's body. And so this is a graph showing, you know, what the relative contributions of graft versus host disease are to relapse. And so this is the probability of relapse on the y-axis, and this is time in years from the day of transplant on the x-axis. And then these were all leukemia patients. And so the data is subsetted into various groups here. And so in this top curve, the curve that has the most relapse are patients who received an allogeneic transplant from their identical twin. So there's no immunologic disparity in that donor-recipient pair. And so, there is no GVHD, graft versus host disease, that occurs. At the very bottom of the curve are patients who developed both acute and chronic graft versus host disease, so the most GVHD that you could possibly have. And so what's interesting to note is that, you know, if you develop GVHD, you actually have less relapse. But then if you look closely, it's not all GVHD is the same. So these are patients who did not develop any GVHD here. And then right under that curve are patients who only developed acute GVHD. And then after that are patients who only developed chronic GVHD. And so what we see is that acute GVHD doesn't improve your chances of not having relapse much more than not having GVHD. And it's really only having chronic GVHD that is associated with a graft versus tumor effect. If you get both acute and chronic GVHD, that's not much better than just having chronic GVHD. So that's why it's very important to control acute GVHD as much as possible. It's okay to have a little bit of chronic GVHD because it's associated with this graft versus tumor effect. And so this is data looking at what the day 100 survival is of patients who develop graft versus host disease. It's subdivided into different grades. The higher the grade, the worse GVHD you have. And so what we see is that if you develop grade 4 GVHD, your day 100 survival was only about 25%, compared to about 78 to 90% if you had very mild GVHD. And so this GVHD is not associated with any benefits against tumors. And so that's why it's very important to try to prevent GVHD as much as possible. So GVHD, this is the reaction of the donor's immune system against the recipient's body tissues. The classic triad of symptoms is diarrhea, skin rash, and liver test abnormalities. The skin rash looks like a sunburn, like in this picture over here. Anywhere from 20 to 50% of allogeneic transplant patients will develop some GVHD, and it's associated with a 15 to 20% mortality. So there are two ways to treat GVHD. One is prevention, and the other is treatment. We won't talk about treatment today. We'll only talk about prevention. So here at Roswell, there are three ways that we can prevent GVHD. Three different regimens: micromethotrexate, post-transplant cyclophosphamide, and then alpha-beta T-cell depletion and CD34 selection. And so we won't talk about micromethotrexate because we are using it less and less, but we'll talk about post-transplant cyclophosphamide. So this is the cyclophosphamide metabolic pathway that we talked about earlier. And so the way post-transplant cyclophosphamide works is that you have a conditioning regimen to prepare the recipient to receive the donor cells. At day zero, the donor cells will go into the patient. So when the donor cells go in, you get stem cells, but you also get T cells, and all of the other cells come along with it. And so when they enter the body, these T cells start proliferating in response to various antigens that they are seeing. On days 3 and 4, we will give a very high dose of cyclophosphamide. And because these T cells are preferentially sensitive to cyclophosphamide because they do not express aldehyde dehydrogenase as much, then they are quickly killed off by the cyclophosphamide. And then on day 5, we start the other immunosuppressants. So this is another way to look at it. On day 0, you have these T cells entering the patient, the recipient. They kind of float around, and if they see antigens that they are specific for, they will start proliferating. On days 3 and 4, we will give high-dose cyclophosphamide to preferentially kill off these activated T cells. Okay. And so these are the T cells that are causing GVHD now. And then the non-activated T cells can persist in the patient. Okay. The other way of preventing GVHD is by alpha-beta T cell depletion and CD34 selection. So in 1966, Frank Billingham proposed these criteria for thinking about graft versus host disease. And, you know, he proposed that you needed three things in order to have graft versus host disease. You needed to have a graft that was immunologically active, so it could respond to any antigens that were in the recipient. You needed antigenic differences between the recipient and the donor. So there had to be something different for those donor cells to detect. And finally, the recipient could not be able to reject the donor cells and get rid of them. So, you know, I think it's important to think about this framework when we think about how post-transplant cyclophosphamide works. So this is the picture for post-transplant cyclophosphamide. In this picture, you have a conditioning regimen which immunosuppresses the recipient, so that the recipient can't reject the donor cells when they're given. You have donor cells that come in that can react against recipient antigens, as evidenced by this T cell proliferation. And then, because this is an allogeneic transplant, you have antigenic differences between donor and recipient. Okay. So we'll move on to alpha-beta T cell depletion. A little bit different, but the same idea. You know, for post-transplant cyclophosphamide, we had an in vivo depletion of T cells. For alpha beta T cell depletion, we have an ex vivo depletion of T cells. So these are all of the cells that are present in the graft. The gray cells are the T cells. This is based on the Miltenyi, I forget what it's called in the lab. You guys do Miltenyi? Nope. Okay, so So these are the T cells, and these are iron particles, and these are antibodies against T cells that can also bind to the iron particles. So you mix all of these together, and you form these clusters of iron particles, antibodies, and T cells. So this is what you get, and you pour this whole thing into a Clinimax machine, which is essentially a plastic tube with magnets around it. These T cells and iron particles and antibodies stick to the magnets. All of the other cells flow through. So essentially what you have is you have pulled out all the T cells from the graft. This is then given to the patient. And then the T cells are thrown away. CD34 selection works similarly. So CD34 is a marker for the hematopoietic stem cell. This is the graft that you collect from donors, antibodies against CD34. CD34 is the blue cell, and then the iron particles. You mix all this together and you form these clusters of CD34 cells, antibodies, and iron particles. Run it through the Clinimax machine. The CD34 cells are retained by the magnets. Everything else flows through, gets thrown away, and then this comes out and it's given to the patient. So once again, we're having depletion of T cells, either by positive or negative selection. And then if we think about Willingham's framework, how this works to prevent GVHD, the Clinimax machine is taking out T cells, so you don't have donor T cells going into the patient. And that's how there's prevention of GVHD. Okay, so it's just a comparison of the different prophylaxis regimens that we have for graft versus host disease. This is alpha beta T cell depletion, also CD34 selection. This is post transplant site, and then we also do micromethotrexate here, but we did not talk about this. And so, the things that are in common are that the targets are all T cells. The differences are ex vivo depletion for alpha beta T cell depletion versus in vivo for post transplant cyclophosphamide. And then there are some minor differences in the other immunosuppressants that we use. Okay. So I bring this up again, and it's just to emphasize that the anti-tumor effects are entirely from chronic graft versus host disease. There is almost none that you get from acute graft versus host disease, and so we should try to prevent acute graft versus host disease as much as possible. So what is this chronic graft versus host disease that I keep talking about? So this is a post-transplant complication that usually occurs after 100 days after the cells go in, and it's characterized by an entirely different set of symptoms than acute graft versus host disease. Usually we see fibrotic skin disease as a result of the immune reaction in the skin, and then patients will also present with dry mouth and gritty eyes due to the fibrosis of their salivary glands and their tear glands. And then sometimes we'll see gastrointestinal fibrosis with malnutrition. So probably about 50% of long-term survivors will develop some form of chronic graft versus host disease. And this is the major cause of long-term mortality in survivors of allogeneic transplant. So these are some pictures of patients with chronic graft versus host disease. This is an example of the skin fibrosis that we see. Most of the time our skin is pretty soft and pliable, but if you were to feel this patient's skin, you would see that it's pretty hard and indurated. The other problem with chronic graft versus host disease is that you develop contractures in your joints. So this guy is trying to raise his arms above his shoulders. We can all do it pretty easily, but he can't do it because the soft tissue that's under his arms has scarred and contracted, and so it's literally keeping him from raising his arms. This is the same sort of process, the fibrotic process, in the arm and then across the shoulders here. And then these are pictures of some of the oral manifestations for chronic graft versus host disease, the sort of lichenification and scarification of the mouth. Okay, so let's do sample questions. So you have a 57-year-old man who's diagnosed with a fascinating and previously undescribed tumor. You give this patient standard chemotherapy, which reduces the mass, but only for a short duration. And so in vitro, the tumor has the following response curve. Okay? And so you're asked, you know, they send this guy to you for a transplant consult. So you're asked what sort of transplant you would do and why. Any? You can't answer because you know the answers. Sorry.
That's why.
Sorry?
Autologous transplant.
Right, so you would do an autologous transplant because this has a this has a response curve where the more chemotherapy you give, the more cytoreduction you have, the more cell killing you get. And so if you give a high dose of chemotherapy, then you're likely to get rid of the tumor. Okay. So you do the transplant, you know, the patient's fine, you get rid of the tumor, but then 2 years later the tumor recurs and you start chemotherapy to get it under control while you're figuring out what to do. And so this tumor now has the following growth characteristics. So whereas before the chemotherapy response curve was a diagonal, you see that it has now plateaued, it goes up some and then it kind of peters out. And then this is the corresponding toxicity curve. So as you would predict, the more chemotherapy you give, the more toxicity you get. Okay, and you also find that this tumor is immunogenic. So how would you change your transplant therapy now? Right, so because it's immunogenic, you could rely on an allogeneic transplant. You could rely on that disparity between donor and recipient to get rid of the tumor for you. And then because of this toxicity curve, then you would, you know, it would make sense for you to choose a reduced intensity conditioning regimen because, you know, you could get this much accomplished without causing all of this toxicity later on. Okay. So this poor guy gets planned to receive an allogeneic transplant, and then they do a donor search, and these are the donors that are available, and then these are the donors that are available. And so how would you prioritize which donor you would use to get the best graft versus tumor effect, but also to reduce the amount of complications that the patient had, such as graft versus host disease. So this is a bit unfair because it's like super busy and you have to deal. Sorry, go ahead.
Second donor, because that has only one DQ mismatch, all the other
they have a low expression DQ.
Oh yeah, low expression.
So you want to choose that over the high expression.
Okay, so this is, I give the answer. Oh, I don't give the answer.
Oh.
Okay, so yeah, you're right. So this is a DQ single antigen DQ mismatch in the middle here, and then the mismatch is at this one here, DQ1, and then this is a single antigen A mismatch, A1 here, A5 here. So this is low expression level allele, This is high expression level allele. So you would choose the low expression level allele over the high expression level allele to avoid GVHD. And then on the far right are haploidentical donor, right? So this is a haploidentical donor. So even more disparity. So if, you know, if all things being equal, you would choose the low expression level allele antigen mismatch. Okay. So, you know, as it often turns out, you know, these two donors deleted themselves in the registry, or they refused to donate. And so, it happens. And so the only donor available is the haploidentical donor. And so the patient receives the haploidentical donor, and he receives acute GVHD prophylaxis with post-transplant cyclophosphamide. So this is, you know, like a really annoying smart patient. You know, he probably scans the internet, and so he asks you, "How does this post-transplant cyclophosphamide thing work? You know, how does it prevent GVHD in me? And then, why aren't my stem cells being killed off by the cyclophosphamide that I get afterwards?" Any? Any? Okay, oops. Okay, so the way this works is...
The way it's metabolized.
Right, so... Right. So,
and the active cells express it more, so, and the hematopoietic cells.
So, those that are active express it at lower levels. So, like,
So this is the hematopoietic hierarchy, right? And so, these are the stem cells, and so what happens in the stem cells is that they express aldehyde dehydrogenase, this enzyme which detoxifies the cyclophosphamide. So when the stem cells see cyclophosphamide, they just kind of laugh at it, they ignore it, because it doesn't affect them. And so that's why we can give cyclophosphamide after transplant and still have the bone marrow grow back. And then with regard to how the GVHD works, if I can find the slide, please. When the T cells proliferate, they express less aldehyde dehydrogenase. So because of that, they are preferentially sensitive to cyclophosphamide. Okay. All right, so that's all I have. Thanks.
Thank you.